Hello, this is Post-Editing Oats. I'm here to tell you that this episode features several accounts of sexual assault and rape in detail. And if that's not something that you wanted to hear or something very, you know, traumatizing for you, now is the time to click off. Have a safe time, have a happy time, and enjoy your listen.
Goose.
I'm drinking off of that mead, bro. It's Thor's day.
It's Odin day.
It's Odin day.
It's Odin's holiday.
You know it.
Looking at us. Anyways, we're back. Are we back? No way.
Unfortunately, we're back.
Not, we're not back.
Yet. We're not back. This isn't real. This is a fever dream you're having right now.
Right? This is like whenever you tell, you're like, oh, guys, I've been listening to this great podcast.
Right.
And they go to search it up. They're like, I can't find it anywhere.
And then turns out it was all a dream.
Right.
It was all in your head.
It was right. All in your head. You've actually been sitting in silence.
You're in the you're in the island right now.
We are the voices in your head.
Yeah. We're Leonardo DiCaprio.
We're Wilson.
Shutter Island.
we're what Wilson is to Tom Hanks.
Yeah. We're just a volleyball in an island. That's all we are. We are Loose Change. We're your host. Yeah, it's definitely Odin Day. We're your host. I'm Cap Brown.
Oats.
Juicy Jane's O.
And this is, I'm gonna get it right this time. This is episode 37.
Holy fuck.
Bam.
He knows what episode we're on.
Right? I stopped drinking, that's why. But yeah, we still got a little bit more of October left, you know what I'm saying? So
one more week.
We still got a couple more stories left for you guys, you know what I'm saying? For all of those that enjoy this season as much as we do, who are avid partakers of the paranormal and the spookiness and the weird...
Occult
shit. I don't know. I don't know what we got today. I don't know.
I don't know. Well, you said, hey guys... Look up something Halloween oriented.
Yeah, we were going to talk about... Well, I actually meant like about the 31st, but I didn't realize how fucking hard that was.
Yeah. Oh, it was hard for me initially because I was like, let me do the culture war type of thing. Let's see like what the hogs are saying about Halloween. Right. Like, how's it evil?
Why do you care? Why do you care about what the hogs are saying, bro?
Because I am.
Why are you so obsessed with the
I'm
hogs?
No better than Fox News. I'm highly reactionary.
Because Oates is the Stephen Colbert of the podcasting.
No. Don't compare me to that lib.
Y'all know Jon Stewart back?
Yes, yeah. I saw a clip of his show.
Yes.
Is he on Apple TV?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No wonder I've been seeing his little cheers. I thought that was like an ongoing thing.
I love it.
He was doing like this whole bit on like what's more Hitler.
I love that shit, COVID. Bro. That shit was so good. Fucking funny. See, that's the shit I miss from like The Daily Show. I don't want no fucking... Like, Trevor Noah is cool. He's not Jon Stewart cool, you know? He's not having a fucking mental breakdown in front of the camera like every night like Jon Stewart used to. And then that's what, you know... He reflected what we were all going to feel like. He knew what was coming, looking ass.
Let's hope he doesn't say anything disappointing.
What do you mean?
Yeah. I mean, for Jon Stewart, bro, been on TV since like
I know
the 80s, and he's been consistent with everything. He used to hang out with like Don Rickles and all of them. You know what I'm saying? Like he knows how to speak. Let's just say it like that. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Why the fuck are we talking about this?
I don't know.
How's y'all's week?
It was alright. Yeah. I've been chilling. Just
say it, bro. Just say you've been big
I've
chilling.
Been big chilling. God fucking damn it.
Big chilling.
I checked out this new sushi. Not new. New to me. This like conveyor belt sushi place.
We were looking for one yesterday. Where'd you go?
I went to Sugarland.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was decent. It was all right.
Mm-hmm.
That's some pretty unique items I've never seen anywhere else.
Do they have some gacha games in there? You have to like buy a certain amount of plates, and then you got like,
yeah, and they get the like a little thing rolls out and gives you like a keychain or whatever.
Been there. It's pretty good.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
That was actually before I liked nigiri.
Oh really?
So like I was like kind of like let down a little bit because I like
we're gonna
like,
bleep
the,
that out.
The hand rolls.
I fucking love nigiri.
Yeah, I do. I do now. I had some sushi last night from this place, in like Midtown, I think, or some downtown. I forgot the fucking name of the area. It all blends into me. but that salmon,
yeah,
it was like buttery, fucking like I've never had salmon so buttery and so like silky. It shows crazy.
That sounds really good.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your favorite type of sushi?
I think we talked about this before. Did we? Like tuna. Yeah.
Tuna?
Yeah.
Okay, I think I changed my mind now.
And then I said from a can.
From a can. I changed mine to Escalar.
White really?
Tuna. White tuna, yeah. I think that's my new favorite.
Yeah, we're going to ask you again in 2 weeks, so you better have a different answer.
I'm going to try to.
I got to keep up the continuity.
Yeah. Got to have a different kinds of tuna.
I like bluefin tuna. I like fatty tuna.
Right.
I like lean tuna.
Peppercorn tuna.
How's your week, Louie?
My week was okay. I've been just working and chilling and working and playing Hunt Showdown. That's my life now. Just working, coming home, and playing Hunt Showdown.
No, I'm literally on call for that game.
Yeah, he's on call.
It'll be evening. Really? I'll get like a cowboy meme.
Yeah.
That just means get on Hunt Showdown.
I sent him a picture of Jake Gyllenhaal getting hugged by his face by Heath Ledger.
Yeah, he said it's time to play Hunt.
It's time.
Because Hunt Showdown takes place in like in Louisiana, like way back then. So everyone's like in cowboy attire and shit.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel it. That's funny. We had a show this weekend. We had a little costume party. The show was
nice.
Pretty cool.
A costume contest?
No, just a little party. Show up with your outfit type shit.
Who had the coolest costume?
Steppy-in? Yeah, there's some beaner shit right there.
Yeah. Steppy-in. Oh, okay. I didn't understand what you were saying. Yeah,
Steppy-in.
Somebody showed up as Steppy-in?
Yeah.
Oh, shit, that's dope.
And then his girl showed up as the
lady Steppy-in?
I forgot her name.
Me too.
Yeah, but that shit was pretty cool. I saw him out, like, in the crowd and shit, because I was getting up on stage and shit, and I was, like, getting everything ready, and I was calling people, and I was like, yo, like, I need everybody to come to the front type shit, you know? And then, basically, I seen him come out of nowhere, and I'm like, holy shit.
No way, he's here.
Oh, my gosh.
Did you do some little song and dance
now
for
is
you?
A party, huh?
Did you do a little song and dance for you, no?
Not that one, but he did perform.
Let's go.
Yeah, he's in a band called Eyes Wide Shut. So if you're interested in rock music, rockish music, you know what I'm saying? Y'all should check him out. Eyes Wide Shut, you know what I'm saying? Little shout out. I also had my homegirl perform, St. Jordo. She's really, really, really fucking dope. And y'all should check her out. Jordan McKinley on SoundCloud.
Sounds dope. I like that name, St. Jordo.
St. Jordo?
I like that.
Yeah, she's really, really fucking dope. One of my favorite, like, actual fucking MCs. Like, I literally, like, anybody I meet that's a rapper, I'd be like, yeah, bro, you ain't shit compared to her. Like, I'll be bold about it. I don't give a shit, bro. Because, like, literally bar for bar, like, if I were to take a census of, like, everybody that's hard, she's number one, I'm number two, and then I got a couple other people, you know what I'm saying? But, like, bar for bar, yeah, no. No, I was gonna perform a song with her, and I guess she got too into her set.
Right.
She forgot to give me the cue, and the song just comes on, and I'm like, "Oh shit!" I had to fucking run on the stage, and by the time I got to the stage, I was all out of breath and shit. I was trying to catch up to the fucking verse, and I'm there. I'm like, I'm just ad-libbing my fucking verse at this point and shit, and then I'm like, damn, you got me off guard. And then I just put the mic and shit, and she continued with her set and shit. But it was pretty cool. Hopefully we get to have more shows and shit like that, because it was a nice vibe. It was pretty cool. If you listen to Loose Change and if you showed up to the fucking show, I fucking love you with all my fucking heart.
Except me.
Yeah, except you guys. Fuck you guys. So, but yeah, this week, I'm going to be talking about a little bit spooky stories, you know what I'm saying? And like we had said earlier, we all have our little anthologies, our little think pieces to give y'all, you know what I'm saying?
I'll hop in the middle because mine is kind of a bummer.
Who wanna?
Nah,
they're bummer. All bummers.
Happy Halloween story, the fuck.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we all don't have like a yeah, and then they lived happily ever after.
I have a tall tale that my father told me when I was young.
Ooh.
I'm pretty sure he made this up. I don't know. Could have been real. You know, there's some old magic in fucking Mexico. So
it makes for great content. It
makes though. For great content. You know yeah. what I mean? So. Remember this story? Whenever I used to tell my, I asked my dad one time if he had any scary stories from that he had experienced in real life, and he was like, "Well, you know, we're on a drive, so he had some time. Tell me a cool little story here." So he's telling me that back in Mexico, whenever he was younger, like it's about around a teenager, maybe a little bit. Maybe 10, 11, 12, something like that. He was with his uncle in this cabin in the woods. They were out there hunting, right? And then, have you guys ever heard of a lechuza?
What is that?
So, a lechuza is what Mexicans...
Like a coyote?
No. Lechuza is what Mexicans think witches turn into, these owls, big owls.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's the owl form of what a witch would be when they transform. And he told me that he was in this cabin with his uncle, you know, out there waiting for some animals to come by. And then next thing you know, lechuzas make a sound, a very distinctive, like a whistle. Like, will this pick up a whistle?
That depends how hard you whistle.
Like that, right? So something like pretty crazy, pretty loud, pretty eerie, pretty screechy. he said he heard that, and immediately they already know what's going on. It's a lechuza. Lechuza's outside. And then they heard another one, and another one, and another one.
Oh my God, it's just fucking whistling?
He said that they went outside and they looked out on the trees, mm-hmm. and they were surrounded by these lechuzas.
Oh my God, that's fucking creepy.
Just a bunch of big ol' owls, big ol' eyes, fucking just looking down at you, you know what I mean?
Bro,
to make it worse, they're Mexican owls.
Yeah, they're Mexican owls, you know what I mean? Undocumented. So.
Well, they're Mexican.
Oh yeah, true. Anyway, so, you know, and he said that his uncle was like, get back inside, you know what I mean? So, they went back inside, shut the door, locked the windows and everything. And my dad's freaking out at this point. He's like, what are we going to do? Like, we're surrounded by these fucking lechuzas. They're going to come down here and fucking kill us. You know what I mean? And he said that his uncle whipped out a handkerchief. You know, like one of those, like, you know, red or blue handkerchiefs that you would see somebody wearing, on, you know, like a certain gangbanging activity handkerchief. You know what I mean?
Okay.
And a bandana. Sorry, that's the word I'm looking for. A bandana.
Handkerchief.
And, he started saying a Hail Mary, you know,
okay.
Reciting a Hail Mary. And for every Hail Mary, he would tie a knot in the bandana.
What the hell? I guess that's the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So he would tie a
knot. Oh, I guess like to mimic like the bead of a rosary.
So he would tie the knot and move on to the next one. Next thing you know, he starts hearing the fucking lechuza just drop. Bah!
What the hell? Like drop dead or something?
On the ground. And then, like, he did, I think, like, 6 or 7 of those Hail Marys. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then he said that by, like, as soon as they stopped hearing the fucking lechuza drop, they went outside and they saw 7 women surrounding them, naked, just on the ground. You know, they had been defeated.
They had been defeated.
So he says that they went up to one, and they were like, why are you here? And he said that they were sent to kill them. By one of their other uncles.
What the hell?
This is a story of betrayal. So the other uncle was in cahoots with this one witch from town that had, you know, she had some connections to, like, I guess she was kind of like one of, like, the topper higher witches or whatever.
To Covenant.
The Covenant, yeah, the Covenant. And the uncle that had sent out the witches was trying to kill his brother, my dad's uncle, you know, my dad's mm-hmm. uncle, because he had won some land dispute between, you know what I mean?
God, like, damn, resorting to the magics over land.
Yeah, yeah. You know, their dad passed away, and he had handed down some land to the more responsible brother. So the other brother was all pretty upset about that. You know what I mean? He was like, why not me kind of shit? So,
I mean, you
would go do some shit like get a exactly. whole covenant of witches.
You fuck with a covenant of witches. It's clear who's the responsible one here.
So anyway, you know, they got the witch. They said, why, you know, interrogate her and shit like that. And then he said, you know, he told her, you know, get out of here. Next time you come around here, we're going to kill you. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that was that. That was that story. Crazy story. But witches. No. I got another one, too.
Do you?
Go yeah, ahead. My same fuck, my same dad. He told me a story.
That very same dad. Very
same dad. Told
me another story about one time they were out there, like, in their house, just chilling, listening to music. Like, it was like a little family gathering, whatever. They were outside, as they usually are. And then they saw the chusa land on their front yard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, on one of their, like, little palm trees that they had or whatever. And that my dad's cousin was like, look, the chusa. Let's fucking kill it. So he grabbed his rifle, and they tried shooting at it, but the bullet wouldn't go off.
What the fuck? Like, it jammed or something? Or
no, just... no, like, the bullet just wouldn't go off. Like, they would pull the little trigger, the little hammer back,
mm-hmm.
and it just go click.
Oh my god.
And he did it like 3 times, and it just went click.
It's a dud.
And, yeah, shit was crazy.
Wow. Spooky, huh?
Very spooky.
So if you ever see a lechuza, I've actually heard one outside my house.
Did you really?
Yeah, I swear to God.
Oh, you got shooters on you, bro.
That shit, bro, that shit made me run inside my house.
Are you for real?
Yeah, it's fucking scary when you hear the fucking whistle.
Is the whistle like so fucking abrasive it kind of sounds like a screech or something?
Yes. Yeah, oh, it's damn. Loud, it's piercing, it's... I mean, I'm pretty sure it's just an owl, but that shit sounds fucking scary. After you've heard those stories as a child.
Oh, yeah. You know I would fucking panic, bro.
I would panic.
It scarred you for life.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Spooky. Was that what you were going to present?
For now.
So you're going after oats?
No, you're going after oats.
So you're going right now?
That was my presentation.
That yeah. That's,
oh,
that's what I was asking. So then should I go? I guess.
Okay.
I guess, you know what I'm saying. I was trying to find some stories. You know what I'm saying. I found something that, you know, for all the kids out there. You know what I'm saying. Spooky for all the Houston kids. Spooky. Damn. You know what I'm saying. We're about to scar them for life. You know, type shit. You know what I'm saying.
I'm ready.
Fucking. There was a couple of stories that took place in Houston. There's actually two of them. And there's two Candyman, by the way, here in Houston.
You motherfucker, you took my subject.
That was what you were going to do?
The Candyman?
Or which like one?
The man that ruined Halloween?
Which one, though? That's what I was about to talk about.
Pixie Stick.
Yeah, that's what I was
God like. Damn it.
But, look, check it out. I got both of them, though.
Okay, you got
so
both of them.
So I could do the other okay, Candyman, yeah, and then you could do Pixie Stick. Candyman, you know what I'm saying? Kevin was like, what if he don't like pixie sticks?
You just killed your friend that does like pixie sticks.
Yeah, so pretty much the other Candyman is known as Dean Arnold Carl. So, you know what I'm saying? He was a dude that was nasty, nasty, nasty. You know, his reign of terror went from 1970 through 1973 in Houston and Pasadena, Texas. So, fucking Pasadena old heads, they know the story, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, if you're like in your 20s and you know your parents grew up here and you grew up here, they probably told you the story, you know what I'm saying? Probably not. So he was basically Dean Arnicoro, he was aided by two teenage accomplices, David Owen Brooks and Elmer Wayne Henley. So then the crimes became known as the Houston Mass Murders. And then it basically came to light, and only came to light after Henley fatally shot Coral.
Oh, shit.
What the? Right. So basically... Basically, so our story starts with, you know, following the honorable discharge from the Army. Coral returned to Houston Heights and resumed the position he had held as vice president of Coral Candy Company.
How the fuck?
Coral's former stepfather had retained ownership of the family's former candy business, Pecan Prince.
Love nepotism. Following,
following his mother's divorce in 1963, competition between the two firms was fierce. As had been the case of in his teenage years, Coral increased the number of hours he devoted to the candy business to satisfy an increasing public demand for his family's product. In 1965, Coral Candy Company relocated to 22nd Street, directly across the street from Helms Elementary School. Coral was known to give out free candy to the local children, in particular, teenage boys.
Ooh.
As a result of his behavior, he earned himself the nickname Candyman. And
that has to be like the worst fucking nickname, man.
You want to know his other nickname?
What is it?
The Pied Piper.
Oh my god.
So you pick.
Pedophile. Like, you just hear Candyman? Pedophile.
Well, you're about to find out. The company employed a small workforce, and he was seen to be, behave flirtatiously towards several teenage male employees. Coral is known to have installed a pool table at the rear of the candy factory where employees and local youths will congregate.
Local youth.
So his friendship with David Brooks, you know, it started in 1967 when he befriended 12-year-old David Owen Brooks. Then, basically, he was a sixth grade student, you know, and he was one of, like, the many that he would give out free candy to. So Brooks initially became one of Coral's many useful close companions, regularly socializing Coral and various teenagers who would come to the factory, you know, to the pool table and shit, you know. He also joined Coral on the regular trips he took to South Texas beaches in the company of various youths and later
Wait, he's taking the youth to like the beaches?
Yeah.
What the fuck? Oh well, yeah, well like this was like 70s, right?
Yeah.
Okay, know. So like this was before like the Stranger Danger shit in the 80s.
No, it's okay back then.
Yeah, people were like, yeah, go on Timmy, you can be away 30 miles from home.
They had a lot of trust in people back in the day, man.
Yeah. Coral was the first adult male who didn't mock his appearance. So whenever Brooks told Coral he needed cash, Coral would give him cash. And then the youth became, he began to see him more as a father figure, you know. So basically, upon Coral's urging, a sexual relationship gradually developed between the two. Beginning in 1969, Coral paid Brooks cash or with gifts to allow him to perform fellatio on the youth.
Oh my god.
Brooks' parents were divorced. His father lived in Houston and his mother had relocated to Beaumont. Yeah, Houston people know how far that is.
So it's fucking far.
It's far.
You said Beaumont?
Beaumont.
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 Okay. Is it pecan or pecan?
Pecan.
Pecan.
Oh, this mother.
In 1970, when he was 15, Brooks dropped out of Waltrip High School and moved to Beaumont to live with his mother. Whenever he visited his father in Houston, he would also visit Coral, who allowed him to stay at his apartment if he wished to. Later the same year, Brooks moved back to Houston. By his own later admission, Brooks began regarding Coral's apartment as his second home. By the time Brooks dropped out of high school, Coral's mother and his half-sister Joyce had moved to Colorado after a failure of her third marriage and the closure of Coral Candy Company in June 1969. Although she often talked to her eldest son on the telephone, his mother never saw him again. Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun, dun. Following the closure of the candy company, Coral took a job as an electrician at the Houston Lighting and Power Company, where he tested electrical relay systems. He worked in this employment until the day of his death. Dun, dun, dun.
Very bleak.
So between 1970 and 1973, Coral is known to have killed a minimum of 28 victims. A minimum of minimum? 28 victims. All his victims were males aged 13 through 20, the majority of whom were in their mid-teens. Most victims were abducted from Houston Heights, which was then a low-income neighborhood northwest of downtown Houston. With most abductions, he was assisted by one or both of his teenage accomplices, David Owen Brooks and Elmer Wayne Hanley. Several victims were friends of one of both Carl's accomplices. Other individuals with whom Carl had himself became acquainted prior to their abduction and murder. And two other victims, Billy Balch, I think that's how you say it, and Gregory Mally Winkley were former employees of the Carl Candy Company. Carl's victims were usually lured into either one of the two vehicles he owned, a Ford Ecoline van or a Plymouth GTX. A Plymouth GTX, that's funny.
I wouldn't know.
Keep it in the theme of Halloween. Ugh. So this enticement was typically an offer for a party or a lift, and the victims would be driven to Coral's house. At Coral's residence, the youths would be plied with alcohol or other drugs until they passed out, tricked into donning handcuffs, or simply grabbed by force. They were stripped down naked and then tied to Coral's bed, usually a plywood torture board, which was regularly hung on the wall. Once they were, you know, drugged out or shit, you know, he would, you know, sexually assault. You don't say the R word no more. Beaten, tortured, and sometimes after several days killed by strangulation or shooting with a 22 pistol caliber pistol.
No one was hearing that shit?
It's the 70s, so it's a different time.
Yeah, hearing wasn't that good back then.
Hearing wasn't invented till 92. So, their bodies were then tied up in plastic sheeting and then buried in one of four places. A rented boat shed, a beach on the Boulevard Peninsula, a woodland near St. Rayburn, where Coral's family owned a lakeside log cabin, or a beach in Jefferson County. In several instances, Coral forced his victims to either phone or write their parents with explanations for their absence in effort to allay their parents' fears for their son's safety. He is also known to have retained keepsakes, usually keys from his victims. During the years in which he abducted and murdered his victims, Coral often changed addresses. However, until he moved to Pasadena in the spring of 1973, he had always lived or stayed close to Houston Heights.
This dude's like fucking loaded. Like,
well, he had a whole ass candy.
I mean, company. Yeah, I know, but like, damn, like, fuck, no one was like questioning this shit.
It's a different time. Questioning didn't come out till like 85. Carl killed his first known victim at an 18-year-old college freshman named Jeffrey Conan with a K. And on September 25th, 1970, Conan vanished while hitchhiking with another student from the University of Texas to his parents' home in Houston. He was dropped off alone at a corner in Westheimer and South Foss Road near uptown area of Houston. Carl likely offered Conan a lift to his house, which Conan evidently accepted. At the time Conan's disappearance, Carl lived in an apartment in Yorktown Street near the intersection of Westheimer Road. Mm-hmm. So for those that are like Houston natives, you're putting it together in your head right now. You're looking at the murder puzzle.
Yeah, you're like Sherlock Holmes the fucking event.
The map, know, you're map tracing. Brooks led police to Conan's body on August 10, 1973. The body was buried at High Island Beach. Forensic scientists subsequently deducted that the youth had died from asphyxiation caused by manual strangulation in a cloth gag that had been placed in his mouth. The body was found buried beneath a large boulder covered with a layer of lime, wrapped in plastic, naked and bound-handed, and with his feet bounded as well with a nylon cord, suggesting he had been sodomized, you know. At the time of Conan's murder, Brooks interrupted Carl in the act of sexually assaulting two teenage boys who he, Coral, has strapped to a four-poster bed. So Coral promised Brooks a car in return for his silence. Brooks accepted the offer, and Coral later bought him a green Chevrolet convertible. So that was that was that car that we were talking about earlier. Coral later told Brooks that he had killed the two youths and offered him $200, or equivalent of $1,300 in 2020. Damn. inflation be a motherfucker.
Right?
So on December 13, 1970, Brooks lured two 14-year-old Spring Branch youths named James Glass and Danny Yates away from a religious rally held in Houston Heights to Coral's Georgetown apartment. Glass was an acquaintance of Brooks, who, at Brooks' behest, had previously visited Coral's address. Both youths were tied to opposite sides of Coral's torture board and subsequently were strangled and then buried in a boat where boat shed he had rented on November 17th. An electrical cord with alligator tip clips attached to each end was buried alongside Yates' body.
Six
weeks later, after the double murder of Glass and Yates on January 30, 1971, Brooks and Coral encountered the two teenage brothers, Donald and Jerry Waldrop, walking towards their parents' house. The Waldrop brothers had been driven to a friend's house to a friend's home by their father with plans to discuss forming a bowling league and had began walking home after learning their friend was not home. Both boys were enticed into Coral's van and then driven into an apartment Coral had rented at Mangum Road, where they were tortured, strangled.
Is it Mangum or Mangum?
Mangum.
Oh shit, I've been down that road.
Yeah. So basically, you know, they were buried in the boat shed. So,
man, how is he like... Is no one noticing a smell? Like, what's going on? We live in Texas. It's fucking hot, man.
Smell didn't come till like 78.
Everyone was missing like three of their senses back then.
Yeah, that shit didn't hit till Reaganomics. Between March and May 1971, Carl abducted and killed three victims, all whom lived in Houston Heights and all were buried towards the rear end of the rented boat shed. In each of these abductions, Brooks is known to have been a participant. One of these three victims, 15-year-old Randall Harvey, was last seen by his family on the afternoon of March 9, cycling towards Oak Forest, where he worked part-time as a gas station attendant. Harvey was driven into Coral's Mangum Road apartment, where he was subsequently killed by a single gunshot wound to the head. The two other victims, 13-year-old David Hillegies and 16-year-old Gregory Malley Winkley, were abducted and killed together on the afternoon of May 29th, 1971.
Oh my God.
As had been the case with parents of other victims of Coral, both sets of parents launched a frantic search for their sons. One of the youths who had volunteered offered to distribute posters to the parents that had printed offering of monetary reward for information leading to the boys' whereabouts was 15-year-old Elmer Wayne Hanley, a lifetime friend of Hillegies. The youth pinned the reward posters around the heights and attempted to reassure Hillegies' parents that there may had been an innocent explanation for the boys' absence. On August 17, 1971, Coral and Brooks encountered a 17-year-old acquaintance of Brooks named Reuben Watson Henney walking home from a movie theater in Houston. Brooks persuaded Henney to attend a party at the address of Coral had moved onto San Felipe Street the previous month.
San Felipe Street?
No way.
I've been there.
Henley agreed and was taken to Coral's home, where he had subsequently strangled and buried in the boat shed.
Boat shed again.
I mean, he rented it for a reason. Shit, he rented it for a reason. In 1971 September, Coral moved to another apartment in the Heights. Brooks later stated that he had assisted Coral in the abduction and murder of two youths during the time Coral resided in this address, including one youth who was killed just before Wayne Hanley came into the picture, quote unquote. In this confession, Brooks stated that the youth killed immediately prior to Hanley's involvement and then the murder abducted from the Heights and kept alive for approximately 4 days before the murder. The identity of both of these two victims still remains unknown. So he killed a couple people.
Yeah, a double digit.
They don't know.
Damn. Not a couple.
They don't know.
It's a lot.
Participation of Elmer Hanley. In the winter of 1971, Brooks introduced Hanley to
Halloween, right? Huh? It's still Halloween, right?
Yeah. That's when I mean, I could do the other Candyman.
No, I'm doing it.
So in 1971, Brooks introduced Henley to Coral. Henley likely was lured to Coral's address as an intended victim. However, Coral evidently decided that the youth would make a good accomplice and offered him the same fee, $200. For any boy who he could lure into his apartment.
Oh my God. Informing
Henley that he was involved with a white slavery
he
ring.
He walked so Jeffrey Epstein could run.
Did you hear what I just said?
Wait, what did he say?
He said he offered him the same fee of $200 for any boy he could lure into his apartment, informing Henley that he was involved in a white slavery ring operating from Dallas.
What?
You know?
Yeah, because that, you know.
Yeah, you have a lot of those.
There's a lot of that going around.
So Henley later stated that for several months, he ignored Coral's offer. However, in early 1972, he decided to accept the offer because he and his family were in dire financial circumstances. Henley said the first abduction he participated in occurred during the time Coral resided at 925 Shoulder Street, an address he moved to in February 1972.
So he went back to like where he did his first killing?
Yeah. So,
why?
We're going to continue the story after we come back from break because this shit's getting too intense. I'm sweating.
Yeah, no, I am actually here. I think it's the mead, but I'm getting hot.
So, whenever we come back, we're going to finish the story and we're going to be speaking to Ashton Kutcher. Is he showering now?
Probably not.
About time.
And we're back.
We're back. And we're better than ever.
Are we?
No.
Spiritually.
Spiritually, yes.
Saved our souls from damnation. Looking ass. That's crazy. That's going to dictate our fucking breaks now. So basically, where we left off previously on Loose Change. Where were we?
Where were you is the good question.
So basically, we just have found out that, you know, Henley has been assistant Coral with all the mergers, you know what I'm saying, in return for a Corvette, you know.
Corvette and, like, what, $200, $100?
Corvette, $200.
Per person?
No, just to shut the fuck up.
Oh, just, okay.
Just to shut the fuck up, you know what I'm saying? And then pretty much they enlisted help of other people, okay. You know what I'm saying? So basically, where we left off, so... Brooks later claimed that Henley had become involved in the abductions while Coral resided at the address he had occupied immediately prior to the Shoulder Street. So, if Henley's statement is to be believed, the victim was abducted from the Heights in February or early March of 1972. In the statement Henley gave to the police following his arrest, the youth stated that Coral picked up a boy at the corner of 11th and Sudawood and lured him to Coral's home with the promise of smoking some marijuana.
Oh, the devil's lettuce.
At Coral's residence, using a ruse he and Coral had prepared, Henley cuffed his own hands behind his back, freed himself with a key hidden in his back pocket, then dumped the youth into a donning, then duped the youth into donning the handcuffs before observing Coral bind and gag him. Henley then left the youth alone with Coral, believing he was about to be sold into sexual slavery. The identity of his first victim Henley assisted in the abduction still remains unknown.
Damn, man.
So, 1 month later, on March 24th, 1972, Henley, Brooks, and Coral encountered an 18-year-old acquaintance of Henley, of Henley's named Frank Aguirre. Sure, let's go with that.
Aguirre.
Frank Aguirre, leaving a restaurant on Yale Street where the youth worked. Henley called Aguirre over to Coral's van and invited the youth to drink beer and smoke some marijuana with the trio at Coral's apartment. Aguirre agreed and followed the trio to Coral's home in Rambler. Inside Coral's house, Aguirre smoked marijuana with the trio before picking up a pair of handcuffs Coral had left on his table. In response, Coral pounced on Agar and pushed... What was the name again?
Aguirre.
Aguirre. There you go. Aguirre. Pushed him into a table. and cuffed his hands behind his back. Henley claimed later that he would not known of Carl's true intentions toward Aguirre when he had persuaded his friends to accompany him to Carl's home. In a 2010 interview, he claimed to have attempted to persuade Carl not to assault and kill Aguirre once he, Carl, and Brooks had bound and gagged the youth. However, Carl refused, informing Henley that he had been sodomizing, torturing, and killing all the previous victims he had assisted in abducting, and that he intended to do the same thing with Aguirre. Henley subsequently assisted Carl and Brooks in Aguirre's burial at High Island Beach. Despite the revelation that Carl was, in reality, killing the boys he and Brooks had assisted in abducting, Henley nonetheless became an active participant in the abductions and murders. 1 month later, on April 20th, he assisted Carl and Brooks in the abduction of another youth, a 17-year-old named Mark Scott. Scott, who had been known to both Henley and Brooks, was gagged by force and fought furiously against attempts by Carl to restrain him, even attempting to stab his attackers with a knife. However, Scott saw Henley pointing to a pistol towards him, and according to Brooks, Scott just gave up. Scott was tied to the torture board and suffered the same fate as Aguirre. Sodomization, torture, strangulation, and burial at the High Island Beach. Brooks stated Henley was especially sadistic in his participation in the murders committed at Shoulder Street. Before Carl vacated the address on June 26, Henley assisted Carl and Brooks in the abduction of murder of two youths named Billy Blouch and Johnny DeLome. In Brooks' confession, he stated that both youths were tied to Carl's bed, and after their torture and sodomization, Henley manually strangled Blouch, then shouted, "Hey, Johnny," and shot DeLome in the forehead, with the bullet exiting through the youth's ear. DeLome then pleaded with Henley, "Wayne, please don't," before he was strangled. Both youths were buried at High Island Beach. Dun, dun, dun.
Damn, that's some man.
Fucked up shit, bro.
These are like actual fucking monsters. Like,
yeah. The Candyman. During the time Carl resided at Short Street, the trio lured a 19-year-old named Billy Rinder to the house. Riddinger was tied to the plywood board, tortured and abused by Carl. Brooks later claimed he had persuaded Carl to allow Riddinger to be released, and the youth was allowed to leave the residence. On another occasion during the time Carl resided at Shoulder Street, Henley knocked Brooks unconscious as he entered the house. Carl then tied Brooks to his bed and assaulted the youth repeatedly before releasing him. Despite the assault, Brooks continued to assist Carl in the abduction of victims. After vacating the Shoulder Street residence, Carl moved to an apartment at Westcott Towers, where in the summer of 1972, he is known to have killed two further victims. The first of these victims was 17-year-old Steven Sigmund. So he was last seen leaving a party held in the Heights shortly before midnight on June 19th. The youth was savagely bludgeoned about the chest with a blunt instrument before he was strangled and buried in the boat shed.
Boat shed again.
Gotta go back. Approximately 1 month later, about...
Are they, like, stored in the freezer or something? What's going, like, come on?
I think he's just burying them.
He's just burying? Like,
I think so.
Okay.
Because I don't
know. I mean, he must be... Damn, bro, like... I guess these weren't really, like, shallow graves for them to, like, really come up.
I mean, because, like, yes, help.
True, yeah.
You know. So, approximately 1 month later... Or about August 21st, 19-year-old named Roy Bunton was abducted while walking to his job as an assistant in a Houston shoe store. Bunton was gagged with a section of Turkish towels in his mouth, and his mouth was bounded with adhesive tape. He was shot twice in the head and buried in the boat shed. Neither youth was named by either Brooks or Henley as being victims of Carl. Both youths were only identified as victims in 2011. On October 2nd, 1972, Henley and Brooks encountered two high teenagers named Wally J. Simon, it's French, bro. I'm not even going to try. And Richard Hembry. Walking to Hembry's home, Simauks and Hembry were enticed into Brooks's Corvette and then driven to Coral's Westcott Tower apartment. That evening, Simon is known to have phoned his mother's home and to have shouted the word Mama into the receiver before the connection was terminated. The following morning, Hambry was accidentally shot in the mouth by Hanley, with the bullet exiting through his neck. Several hours later, both youths were strangled to death and subsequently buried at a common grave inside of the boat shed.
God damn, dude.
So, I guess.
Yeah. Buried.
Very, very deep grave.
Very fucking deep. Because, like, ain't no way, like, you're, like, laying out all those bodies for, like, their own little graves. It has to be, like, one massive pit. Yeah,
he put him pretty much on top of James Glass and Danny Jade's body.
Jesus, man.
So, sometime the following month, an 18-year-old Oak Forest used note both to Carl and Hanley named Willard Branch disappeared while hitchhiking Mount Pleasant to Houston. His gagged and emasculated body was buried in the boat shed as well. On November 15, a 19-year-old Heights youth named Richard Kepner disappeared on his way to a phone booth. Kepner was strangled and buried at High Island Beach. Altogether, at least 10 teenagers between the ages of 13 and 19 were murdered between February and November of 1972, five of whom were buried at High Island Beach and five inside the boat shed.
Man, like, this is, like, within, like, the same area as well. Like, it's just... Yeah.
H-Town holding it down.
Like, how is family and, like, hold up. All these people are going missing. Like, something fishy going on.
I mean, I'm pretty sure they're, like, knowing something's happening, but they just can't, like, figure it out.
They can't figure it out. Yeah, right. Okay, so, like, this is... 'Cause like 70s, right?
Like, yeah, because, like, dead ass, like, being real this time, like, that's before, like, DNA evidence and all that shit.
Before DNA, before, like, I don't know about fingerprints, but, like, a lot of, like, the modern technology and a lot of, like, the accessible cameras and stuff were not everywhere. Yeah,
and if he's not convicted, then the fingerprints wouldn't show up.
God.
So, you know. They would just have fingerprints, but until he commits a crime, like, an actual crime that he gets arrested for type shit, like, they wouldn't know, you know. So, on January 20th, 1973, Coral moved to an address on Wirt Road in Spring Branch District of Houston. Within 2 weeks of moving into his address, he had killed 17-year-old Joseph Lyles. Lyles was known to both Coral and Brooks. He had lived on Antoine Drive, the same street upon which Brooks resided in 1973. On March 7th, Coral vacated his Wirt Road apartment and moved to 2020 Lamar Drive, an address his father had vacated in Pasadena. Ooh. So 2020 Lamar Drive. No victims were killed between February 1st and... no known victims. Let me say that. No known victims were killed between February 1st and June 4th of 1973. Coral is known to have suffered from a hydrocele in early 1973, which may have contributed to this period of inactivity. In addition to around the time where Lyle's murder, Hanley had temporarily moved away to Mount Pleasant in an apparent effort to distance himself from Coral. These facts may account for the settling low of killings. So, a lot of murders.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff happening.
God damn, bro. How did someone get away with this for so, like, this is insane.
Yeah. So, I'ma skip a little bit because this shit is really intense, you know what I'm saying? And I'm going to try to wrap it up because this is really intense, you know? So, on July 6, 1973, Hanley began attending classes at Coach's Driving School in Bel Air, where he became acquainted with 15-year-old Homer Lewis Garcia. The following day, Garcia phoned his mother to say he was spending that night with his friend, and he was shot and left to bleed to death in Coral's bathtub before he was buried at Lake Sam Rainburn. 5 days later, on July 12, a 17-year-old John Sellers of Orange County was bound and shot to death and buried at High Island Beach. In July 1973, after Brooks married his pregnant fiancée, Hanley temporarily became Coral's sole procurer of victims, assisting in the abduction and murder of three Heights youth between July 19th and the 25th. Hanley claimed that these three abductions were the only three that occurred after his becoming an accomplice to Coral, in which Brooks was not a participant. One of these three victims, 15-year-old Michael Bouch, brother of previously victim Billy Bouch was last seen by his family on July 19th on his way to get a haircut. He was strangled and buried at Lake Sam Rayburn. The other two victims, Charles Cobber and Marty Ray Jones, were abducted together on the afternoon of July 25th. Henley himself later buried both youths' body in the boat shed. So, imagine losing one son.
Then losing the other.
And then losing the other. On August 3rd, 1973, Coral killed his last victim, a 13-year-old boy from South Houston named James Satan Dremala. Dremala was abducted by Brooks and Coral while driving, while riding his bike in Pasadena, and had driven to Lamar Drive upon the pretense of collecting empty glass bottles to resell. At Coral's home, Dremala was tied to Coral's torture board. He was sodomized, tortured, strangled with a cord before being buried in the boat shed. Brooks later described Dremala as a small blonde boy from whom he had bought pizza and whose company he had spent 45 minutes before the youth was attacked. Dun, dun, dun. So Carl's death.
Finally.
On the evening of
Jesus
August 7th, 1973, Henley, age 17, invited 19-year-old Timothy Cordell Curley to attend a party at Coral's Pasadena residence. Curley, a casual acquaintance of Coral who had intended to be his next victim, accepted the offer. Brooks was not present at the time. The two youths arrived at Coral's house where they had sniffed paint fumes and drank alcohol. They were huffing paint and drank alcohol until midnight before leaving the house to purchase sandwiches. Henley and Curley then drove back to Houston Heights, and Curley parked his vehicle close to Henley's home. Henley exited the vehicle and, hearing the commotion across the street emanating from the home of his 15-year-old friend, Rhonda Louise Williams, walked toward home. Williams had been beaten by her drunken father that evening and accepted Henley's invitation to join himself and Curley at Carl's home. Williams climbed into the backseat of Carly's Volkswagen. The trio then drove to Coral's Pasadena residence. At approximately 3 a.m. in the morning of August 8, 1973, Henry and Carly were accompanied by Williams to return to Coral's residence. Coral was furious that Henry had brought a girl to his house, telling him that private...
No girls allowed!
Telling him in private that he had ruined everything! Henley then explained Williams had argued with his father that evening and did not wish to return home. Coral appeared to calm down and offered the trio beer and marijuana. The three teenagers began drinking and smoking marijuana, with Henley and Curley also sniffing paint fumes as Coral watched them intently. After approximately 2 hours, Henley and Curley and Williams passed out. Henley woke to find himself lying upon his stomach and Coral snapping handcuffs to his wrists. His mouth had been taped shut and his ankles had been bound together. Carly and Williams lay beside Henley, securely bound with nylon rope, gagged with adhesive tape, and lying face down on the floor. Curly had been stripped naked. Nothing Henley had awoken. Excuse me. Nothing Henley had awoken. Carl removed the gag from his mouth. Henley protested in vain against Coral's actions, whereupon Coral reiterated that he was angry with Henley for bringing a girl to his house and that he was going to kill all three teenagers after he had assaulted and tortured Curly, initially stating, "Man, you blew it. You blew it by bringing that girl."
He was gonna kill them anyway.
Like, before shouting, "I'm going to kill you all, but first I'm gonna have my fun." Then he repeatedly kicked Williams in the chest before lifting Henley to his feet, dragging him to his kitchen, and placing a .22 caliber pistol against his stomach, threatening to shoot him. Henley calmed Coral, promising to participate in the torture and murder of both Williams and Curly if Coral released him. Approximately 30 minutes after the discussion, Coral agreed and untied Henley, then carried Curly and Williams into his bedroom and tied them to opposite sides of this torture board, Curly on his stomach and Williams on her back. Coral then handed Hurley a hunting knife in order to cut away Williams' clothes, insisting that while he would sodomize and kill Curly, Henry would do the same thing to Williams. Henley began cutting away Williams' clothes as Coral undressed and began to assault and torture Curly. Both Curly and Williams had awakened at this point. Curly began writhing and shouting as Williams, whose gag Henley had removed, lifted her head and asked Henley, "Is this for real?" To which Henley answers, "Yes." Williams then asked Henley, Are you going to do anything about it? Henley then asked Coral whether he might take Williams into another room. Coral ignored him, and Henley grabbed Coral's pistol, shouting, "You've gone too far, Dean. You've gone too far, Dean."
Oh.
As Coral clambered off Curly, Henley elaborated, "I can't go any longer. I can't have you kill all my friends. There you go. That's what he said. Coral approached Henley, saying, "Kill me, Wayne." Henley stepped back a few paces as Coral continued to advance upon him, shouting, "You won't do it." Henley then fired Coral, hitting him in the forehead. The bullet failed to penetrate Coral's skull, and then he continued to lurch towards Henley, whereupon the youth fired another two rounds, hitting Coral in the left shoulder. Coral then ran out of the room, hitting the wall in the hallway. Henley fired three additional bullets into the lower back and shoulder of Coral, slid down the wall in the hallway outside of the room where the two teenagers were bound. Coral died where he fell, his naked body laying face down on the wall. Henley would later recall having to shot Coral then, so thought in his mind that the moment immediately thereafter was that Coral would have been proud of the way he had behaved during the confrontation, adding that he had been training him to react quickly and forcefully, and that this was the exact way he would have wanted to be done.
What the fuck?
So after he had shot Coral, Henley released Curly and Williams from the torture board, and all three teenagers stressed and discussed their actions to take. Henley suggested to Curly and Williams that they should simply leave, to which Curly replied, "No, we should call the police." Henley agreed and looked up the number for the Pasadena Police Department in Coral's telephone directory. At 9:24 on August 8th, 1973, Henley placed a call to the PPD. The PPD. His call was answered by an operator named Vilma Lyons. In this call, Henley blurted to the operator, "Y'all better come here right now. I just killed a man."
Such a Pasadena thing.
Right? Henley gave the address to the operator as 2020 Lamar Drive, Pasadena. As Curly Williams and Henley waited upon Curl's porch for the police to arrive, Henley mentioned to Curly that he had done that four or five times. Shooting, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So minutes later, the PPD patrol car arrived at 2020 Lamar Drive. The teenagers were sitting outside the porch outside the house, and the officer noted that the 22 caliber pistol in the driveway near the trio. Henley told the officer that he was the individual who made the call and indicated that Carl's body was inside the house. After confiscating the pistol and placing Henley, Williams, and Curly inside the patrol car, the officer entered the bungalow and discovered Coral's body inside the hallway. The officer returned to the car and read Henley his Miranda rights. In response, Henley shouted, "I don't care who knows about it. I have to get it off." Curly later told detectives that before the police officer had arrived at Lamar Drive, Henley had informed him, "If it wasn't for my friend, I could have had gotten $200 for you."
What a prick.
So that's where we're gonna end off this story.
What happened to Brooks?
Huh?
What happened to Brooks? He just lived a happily ever after?
Hey, look, man.
Motherfucker's still out there?
This is where we're going to end the story.
Okay, we'll end the story. Y'all can look it up for yourselves. Whatever the fuck happened to Brooks.
Yeah, that's the cliffhanger right there. That So, yeah, that's the story of one of the Candymen.
One of the Candymen, where, like, his Candymen shit ended, like, a quarter of the way in.
He got shot in the head. It still came after him.
Yeah, like, we got Mr. Ballistics expert here, Jinzo. Like, what?
Then the last time he said, like, a 22 cal took down bears.
Yeah, if you hit the right spot.
Looking ass.
So, like, how the fuck did it not penetrate a skull?
Because he's not a bear.
No, yeah, I've actually saw this image of this dude that tried to commit suicide with a 22.
Mm-hmm.
All of the 22s were actually just lodged in his skin.
Really?
Yeah. Like, he shot himself like 7 times with the 22, and he just couldn't get through his fucking skull. So he just suffered a really
bad concussion.
Bad concussion, yeah.
Or, like, I imagine, like, I don't know, can't, like, the fucking vibration waves turn your brain to jelly?
Probably. You know, he probably had, like, a brain damage, but could you imagine trying to kill yourself and then fucking that up?
Dude, I would kill myself.
So, yeah, that's the Candyman.
Okay, let me give my Candyman a little bit more less bleak. I mean, it's still fucked, but, like...
Way less bleak.
Way, like,
I mean, like...
Now, this was a story.
Now, this is a story. Like, this was, like, this is Candyman candy. Like, there's candy involved. There's a... So, my Candyman revolves around same... I'm not same guy. But same... It's the same guy. This is a spinoff story.
Same guy, different name.
Man by the name Ronald Clark O'Brien. He's nicknamed the Candyman and the man who killed Halloween. He was a man convicted of killing his 8-year-old son on Halloween 1974 with a potassium cyanide-laced pixie stick that was ostensibly collected during a trick-or-treat outing. O'Brien poisoned his son in order to claim life insurance money to ease his own financial troubles, as he was $100,000 in debt. O'Brien also distributed poisoned candy to his daughter and 3 other children in an attempt to cover up his crime. However, neither his daughter nor the other children ate the poisoned candy. He was convicted of capital murder in June 1975 and sentenced to death. He was executed by lethal injection in March 1984.
He was given life in prison and a death sentence.
Yeah, I guess so. O'Brien lived with his wife, Diane, in Deer Park, Texas, with their son, Timothy, and daughter, Elizabeth. O'Brien worked as an optician at Texas State Optical in Sharpstown, Houston. He was a deacon at the Second Baptist Church, where he sang in the choir and was in charge of the local bus program. So, contributing member to society and the community around him. Very stand-up guy. So bright. On October 31st, 1974, O'Brien took his 2 children trick-or-treating in a Pasadena, Texas neighborhood. O'Brien's daughter and his 2 children accompanied them. After visiting a home where the occupant failed to answer the door, the children grew impatient and ran ahead to the next home while O'Brien stayed behind. He eventually caught up with the group and produced 5 21-inch pixie sticks, which he would later claim were given to him from the occupant of the house that didn't answer the door.
Oh, shit. He tricked them.
At the end of the evening, O'Brien gave each of the neighbors 2 children pixie sticks and 1 each to Timothy and Elizabeth. Upon returning home, O'Brien gave the 5th pixie stick to a 10-year-old boy whom he recognized from his church. So he's like, oh, why not? Give this guy one.
He's like, hey, Jimmy.
You want a pixie stick?
You want some candy? Right. Oh, gee, mister. I sure will.
What are these staples on them? Before bed, Timothy asked to eat some of the candy he collected, and according to Ronald, he chose the pixie sticks. Timothy had trouble getting the powdered candy out of the straw, so O'Brien helped him loosen the powder. After tasting the candy, Timothy complained that it tasted bitter. O'Brien then gave his son Kool-Aid to wash away the taste. Timothy immediately began to complain that his stomach hurt and ran to the bathroom, where he began vomiting and convulsing. O'Brien later claimed he held Timothy while he was vomiting and the child went limp in his arms. The horrifying. Timothy O'Brien died en route to the hospital less than an hour after consuming the candy.
Oh my god.
This is the dude that, like, literally sparked the whole, like, there's razor blades in the Jolly Ranchers.
They're pretty marijuana candy.
Yeah, the weed man's giving away free edibles.
Right.
Where?
No cap.
Point me in the direction.
That has to be some Calabasas shit.
So, Timothy's death from poison Halloween candy raised fear in the community. Numerous parents in Deer Park and the surrounding area turned in candy their children got from trick-or-treating to the police, fearing it was laced with poison. The police did not initially suspect O'Brien of any wrongdoing until Timothy's autopsy revealed that the pixie sticks he had consumed was laced with a fatal dose of potassium cyanide. 4 of the 5 pixie sticks O'Brien claimed to have received were recovered by authorities from the other children, none of whom who had consumed the candy. The parents of the 5th child became hysterical when they could not locate candy after being notified by the police. So, like,
whoa.
Johnny, where's your candy?
I don't know.
Did you eat it? I don't know.
Johnny?
Yes, Papa?
Eating sugar?
No, Papa.
Telling lies?
No, Papa.
See, if it was us, we would have been snorting the fucking pixie stick.
Oh, yeah, we would have fucking...
Straight to the dome.
Straight to the dome. We probably wouldn't...
Shout out to my boy Gianni.
Oh, my God.
Boy, look built like a Dorito now. Y'all see him?
Yeah, he's fucking...
He's yoked.
He's fucking yoked. I'm proud of him.
He's a fucking triangle with arms, bro. It's crazy.
The parents rushed upstairs to find their son asleep, holding the unconsumed candy. The boy had been unable to open the staples that sealed the wrapper shut. All five of the pixie sticks had been opened with the top 2 inches, refilled with cyanide powder, and resealed with a staple. According to pathologists who tested the pixie sticks, the candy consumed by Timothy King had a stroke.
Yeah.
The candy consumed by Timothy.
Too many pixie sticks.
Yeah, I'm off that potassium cyanide. The candy consumed by Timothy contained enough cyanide to kill 2 adults, while the other 4 candies contained enough to kill 3 or 4 adults.
God damn.
He must have really hated those fucking neighbors. I don't know.
Like, he hated his kid, but he must have hated them a lot more.
So let me get this straight. He got those pixie sticks from the neighbor that the door didn't answer, or did he give them?
Yeah, he quote-unquote got the pixie sticks from the neighbor that wasn't answering the door.
Quote-unquote. I see what you're
saying. Yeah. Okay. O'Brien initially told police that he could not remember which house he got the pixie sticks from. Police became suspicious because O'Brien and his neighbor had only taken their children to homes on 2 streets because it had been raining. Their suspicions increased after learning that none of the homes they visited had given out pixie sticks. After walking the neighborhood with police 3 times, O'Brien led them to the home where no one had answered the door. O'Brien claimed that he went back there before catching up with the group. He said the owner of the home did not turn the lights on, but did crack the door open and hand them 5 pixie sticks. He claimed to have only seen the man's arm, which was described as hairy.
Yeah.
The home was owned by a man named Courtney Melvin. Melvin was an air traffic controller at Hobby Airport and did not get home from work until 11 p.m. on Halloween night. Police ruled Melvin out as a suspect when nearly 200 people confirmed that he had been at work.
Damn, there goes your fucking story. Right?
He goes, what? 200?
200 people? That's fucking crazy. What kind of fucking... They're going ham for this case.
And this That's was... a big survey of people.
That's probably why the fucking other candy man got away with so much. They were focused on this dude.
dare ye, sir?
I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're not releasing this episode.
As their investigation progressed, police learned that Ronald O'Brien was over $100,000 debt. With inflation, that's like over $500,000 now.
Get the fuck out of here, man. Really.
Yeah.
Damn, and the real scary part is inflation in this.
Right, story. Like every time we do a piece on whatever the fuck happened back then, it's like, damn, bro. America's really going down the shitter.
No surprises there.
Right. He had a history of being unable to hold a job. In the 10 years preceding the crime, O'Brien had held 21 jobs. At the time, goddamn, he must have fucking sucked at everything. At the time of his arrest, he was suspected of theft at his job at Texas State Optical, and he was close to being fired. His car was about to be repossessed, and he had defaulted on several bank loans, and the family home had been foreclosed on. Police discovered that O'Brien had taken out life insurance policies on his children in the months preceding Timothy's death. In January 1974, he had taken out $10,000, equivalent to $50,000 now, life insurance policies on both of his children. One month before Timothy's death, O'Brien took out an additional 20,000 policies on both children. Despite the objections of his life insurance agency. In the days preceding Timothy's death, O'Brien had taken out yet another 20,000 policy on each child.
Dumbass, bro. Make it more obvious why don't you? Right.
Oh, shit. See, I would have just gone for a cool million.
The various policies totaled approximately 60,000. O'Brien's wife maintained that she did not know about the insurance policies on her children's lives. Police also learned that on the morning after Timothy's death, O'Brien had called his insurance company to inquire about collecting the policies he had taken out on his son.
Damn, right away he said,
hey, right?
I'm trying to call, cash a check real quick.
It's fucking crazy. After learning that O'Brien had visited a chemical supply store in Houston to buy cyanide shortly before Halloween, police began to suspect that Ronald O'Brien had laced the candies with poison an effort to kill his children.
Oh, they think?
Right? At this point, is it not obvious? They believe he gave the other children poison candy in an effort to cover up his crime.
Damn.
So, they're like...
I wonder what he bought cyanide for. What could he have used that for?
What is he building in there?
What's he building?
He's like, Johnson, call it a hunch, but I think we're onto something.
These kids have cyanide in pixie sticks. These kids died of cyanide.
You want to go get cyanide from the supply store?
Something's not adding up here.
How weird. Life insurance policy. This is weird.
He's like, Margaret, hold my calls. He picks up his fucking hat from the fucking hat thing. He just grabs his coat. Where are you going? I think I have a lead.
Police repeatedly questioned O'Brien, but he maintained his innocence. So stone cold. Like, I didn't do it.
Wasn't me.
Wasn't me. Although police never discovered when or where O'Brien bought the poison, he was arrested for Timothy's murder on November 5th, 1974. He was indicted on one count of capital murder and four counts of attempted murder. O'Brien entered a plea of not guilty on all five counts. O'Brien's trial began in Houston on May 5th, 1975. During the trial, a chemist who was acquainted with O'Brien testified that in summer 1973, O'Brien contacted him asking about cyanide and how much would be fatal. Hey, Jeff.
That's very suspicious. Why would you ask?
How much would it take to kill a man?
What this about dude, a small this child?
Did not, this guy did not cover his tracks whatsoever, bro. Right? Holy shit, this guy sucks.
A chemical supply salesman also testified that O'Brien had asked him how to purchase cyanide. Friends and co-workers testified that in the months before Timothy's death, O'Brien showed an unusual interest in cyanide and spoke about how much it would take to kill a person. This dude was really like, damn, cyanide, cyanide, cyanide.
It's like walking around the park asking for weed.
You got weed on you? Hey, you got weed on you? You selling? Oh, yeah, it's like almost like you would perceive him as a cop.
Type shit, you know?
O'Brien's sister-in-law and brother-in-law testified that on the day of Timothy's funeral, he spoke of using the money from Timothy's insurance policy to take a long vacation, buy other items. As well, his wife rejected the claim that Timothy chose the pixie sticks, stating that O'Brien had, in fact, forced him to choose the sticks. O'Brien continued to maintain his innocence. His defense mainly drew upon the decades-old urban legend concerning a mad poisoner who hands out Halloween candy laced with poison or needles or candy apples with razor blades inserted. These stories have persisted despite the fact there are no documented instances of strangers poisoning Halloween candy.
I would have just blamed Coral.
It had to be Coral.
No, he was shot to death literally 2 years ago.
So there's my candy, man.
Wow.
Wow. Real piece of shits we got on for this episode.
Well, it is the season. I mean, Christmas ain't gonna get any better.
Oh my god.
Krampus.
Can we do like a happy episode? You know, good people that.
Yeah, let's share our best Christmas
stories. I mean, next episode is supposed to be extra loose.
I mean, extra loose, but like, we're still in Halloween.
Yeah.
So, like, we're still telling spooky stories.
I don't think we're going to tell, like, kind of stories, you know?
And quick shout out to my boy Damien. Just thinking about you, bro.
It's kind of gay, but okay. Sure.
That's okay. Sure. We support all lifestyles here at Loose Change.
Damn, I can't believe about the homie. Shit, damn.
All lifestyles?
Hmm?
All lifestyles.
All of them.
All of them.
Except for taking out life insurance policies.
Yeah, no.
We support that, too. You gotta get the bag, bro.
Yeah, honestly, gotta do anything to get the bag.
Okay. Okay. But yeah, shit.
This is a very dark episode.
This was a doozy, if you ask me.
A doozy.
We need to put a threat warning.
Disclaimer.
Disclaimer. Like, this one's long and...
You're gonna kill yourself at the end of this episode.
To take out a trans policy on yourself.
You know they don't pay you out for suicides, right?
Huh?
They don't pay you out for suicides.
It's illegal to kill yourself, bro.
Yes, just don't do it.
Euthanasia.
He's a what?
Euthanasia.
It's illegal.
It's a good Megadeth album.
In Texas.
Psych!
How do they know you're gonna kill yourself?
They don't.
You can just drive off the fucking highway and you get attributed to the fucking poorly built highway system that Houston has.
It's actually really well built.
It's poorly built.
It's dog shit, bro.
They purposely...
Are you criticizing Houston?
Yes, because they purposely built their fucking highways through fucking low-income neighborhoods, and then they don't give a shit about that, and then they know that there's fucking health implications that happen because of all the fucking carbon monoxide and all the people living under the pass and shit like that, and they don't give a shit. They're like, you know what?
More just highway. Move, bro.
We're gonna end the podcast.
Just don't live under the highway. What the fuck?
Right? That's what we're gonna
the
end
housing
up
market
with.
Is not that bad.
You know? It's a free market.
Just don't live there. What the fuck?
Anywho, this has been a very, very disturbed episode.
Yeah, this is like, I think we just ruined Halloween.
No, they ruined Halloween.
Just delete this whole episode, to be honest.
Yeah, this one's on our Patreon. You gotta pay for this one.
Touch it. What'd you learn today, Irby?
What did I learn today? I learned that Jeff Bezos has a huge ego. But.
I mean, would you not have a huge ego if you just made $1 billion trillion off of the small loan of $1 million?
Personally,
small loan.
I'm built different.
Modest small loan of $1 million.
That was Trump.
No, and that was $3 million.
Trump?
Yeah.
No.
It was $3 million.
But he was the one that said the loan.
Yeah, that's his quote.
Yeah, that is his quote. I think Jeff was like $100,000 or something, $200,000.
That's not bad. It's attainable.
But that was like through his family, so.
Exactly.
What about you, Otz? What'd you learn today?
I learned that we should just like glass the entire planet.
Please. Get this shit over with. I'm trying to... Whenever they glass, do they really turn it into glass?
No, it's just a saying because it's scorched earth.
Oh, okay. Scorched earth is good earth.
Is good earth?
Yeah, you can actually like reclaim a lot of land and the soil is very fertile after that.
Yeah, because of the dead bodies.
Mm-hmm. Those are like natural forest fires. I'm talking about like killing all life.
Yeah.
Nothing survives.
Exactly.
It's very damn. Fertile. Do you think that's what our petroleum is now?
What?
Just the souls of the damned.
Probably.
That's crazy.
Right?
We're killing.
Do you think a caveman is like actual fossil fuel?
Caveman?
Yeah, like do you think they kind of like made it
to... Nah, there's still mummies of cavemen, right?
No.
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 No. No.
Mummies?
Not fossilized. Mummies.
There's fossilized.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
But not mummy.
But fossil fuels.
But fossils aren't fuel.
Is that 93 octane?
Are you telling me they don't put bones in a blender and then turn into oil?
Actually, I don't know. What is oil?
It's from pressure.
From pressure?
It's from pressure and heat from the Earth's core. But according to y'all, there's no such thing as a core.
I said it's hypothetically, it's a hypothesis, you know, it's a theory. There might be a core, there might not be a core.
So, yeah, it burns up all that shit, and then it basically turns it into either a diamond or a petroleum. What are Earth? Anyway, we're going to leave you with those bleak-ass fucking thoughts in your head. We were trying to end it up in a light, you know, lighthearted ending, but I don't think
that's... Yeah, I thought these two motherfuckers were gonna have like something nice and light. I mean, Lewis had something nice, light and fun, but fucking Kevin Brown came out here with a whole documentary series of fucking murders.
Mine was just about a guy that had ended up, you know, killing his kid through pixie sticks, but you know, as events came in.
That was Oz's story.
That was my story.
It was originally my story.
No, it was my story. I called
you. Should have gone first.
I called
you. Should have gone first.
I called
you. Should have gone first. I called you. Should have gone first. But you did it. But anyways, this
I'm
been
your host, Kepper Brown.
And that's my line. Anyways, this has been loose change, and we're just gonna end it at that, because you know we can't bring it back from all that shit.
Yeah.
So
unsubscribe right now, please.
I've been Cap Brown, and I'm with
No, I'm Cap Brown.
Fuck you.
I'm Oats.
I'm Juicy Genzo. Perhaps.
Perhaps. We'll put a pin on that, and then we'll be back next week with Ed Sheeran. Is he showering?